Real quick before we start the show, just wanted to let you guys know you can get the show 2 days early by joining our Patreon. Even for a buck, you can listen to the show 2 days early. Go to patreon.com/analogtalk and we got a bunch of stuff over there. Check it out and enjoy the episode. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of Analog Talk, a film photography podcast. I'm your host, Tim.
I'm Chris.
And today on the show, we have the legend, Ray Barbie. Hey, Ray.
Hi, Ray.
Hi, you guys. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah.
I know Timothy's fangirling over here, but...
A little bit.
when I hear legend, it means old. No. So.
By no means. I don't mean it like that.
Yeah, we mean it in the good way. The good way.
No. I'm saying for me. That's what I always think.
Man. So, Ray, can you do us a favor and introduce yourself to our listeners and kind of give them the story and how you got started and all that stuff?
Yeah. So my name's Ray Barbie, and I live in Long Beach, California with my wife, Stephanie, and our two sons, Nolan and Maxwell. And Nolan's going to be 18 here in a few days, and Maxwell is 13. I'm very grateful to be able to have chased my dreams and become a professional skateboarder when I was 17 years old, and that's still what I do to this day. But because of the community and the culture of skateboarding, I was afforded the resources and the environment to explore other interests, which is playing music. I love to play guitar and photography, hence why I'm on this show.
Yes.
And so got into skateboarding when I was 12 years old, and I grew up in San Jose, California. And my buddy Danny that I hung with one summer in between 6th and 7th grade, it was his birthday, and his dad, who used to skate in the 70s, got his son Danny a skateboard, my friend. And when he got that skateboard and he's riding that skateboard and I'm on my bike, I was like, I want one of those. He's having way more fun than me. So that's kind of what started it. And it was at a time when, you know, the late 70s, the park eras, public skate parks closed down because of insurance premiums. Insurance skyrocketed the rates, right? And so these owners couldn't keep the doors open. So late 70s, all these parks get torn down. And then skaters still wanting to skate transition, start building ramps in their backyard. And I came in, I got into skateboarding at the tail end of the backyard ramp era. And around 85, I broke my wrist skating this one ramp. And while I had my cast, parents took my skateboard away from me. But my buddy had a backup one, but we couldn't go skate the ramp. So we were skating street a lot. And during that time of skating street, that's when I realized that, wow, this is what I want to be doing. I want to be out in the streets skating, because it was so uncharted shores, if you will, to a certain degree. Like we had street skaters that we saw in the magazines, but because there were such few photos of street skaters in Thrasher magazine and Trans World back then, it was mostly ramps. There were guys like Tommy Guerrero, Mark Gonzalez, and Natas Kappas. We had those guys, but not much outside of them. So it was a kind of big, empty kind of canvas, if you will. And there was something about that was just really exciting. The idea that we didn't have a long list of tricks that we had to learn. There was a few, and then it was just open. So that was just really exciting, you know? And so we progressed in skating street at a pretty fast rate, if you will. And when I was in high school, I moved from San Jose to Southern California, to Tustin. And when we moved to Tustin, I was in the backyard of pretty much the skate industry and skating with all the pros that I would see in the magazine. And from being out in Southern California and skating with everybody, I got the opportunity to be asked to ride for one of the biggest skateboard companies at that time, which is called Pau Peralta, and was in a video around 1988 called public domain where I was featured with a few other skaters street skating. And that was the first time people on a big scale, because of how big Palo Peralta was at the time and because of how far their videos pushed out, people saw this approach to skateboarding. And it allowed me to turn pro when I was 17, still in high school. And again, very grateful that being a part of that team and with those guys, the Bones Brigade, it played a huge part in why I'm still around to this day and have opportunities and still able to, I guess, technically be considered a pro skater, whatever that looks like at this point for me.
Man, so did your parents ever give your board back, or were they just like, nope? No.
Oh yeah, once the cast was off, yeah. They were like, we don't want you breaking that in the cast again. Oh, yeah.
You're breaking your other arm or something.
Or you're right. Yeah, exactly. Man. So
that's so wild, because I'm like a decade behind you. Like my come up in the skateboarding world was like early 90s, mid 90s, and you guys already paved the way for what we were doing back back at that point. Man.
So where did you grow up? Were you in where are you right now?
Now I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, but originally grew up in the East Coast. I'm like a grew up 40 minutes away from Philly, so it was the whole like Love Park era of skating.
Yeah. So I have a picture in my mind where when you're saying in the 90s where you were. Yeah. Yeah, that whole time. Yeah, that was a good time, man. That was a time when I felt like the East Coast was doing their thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's really cool. Matt Pales, Matt Reason,
Tim O'Connor, man, big fan.
Yeah, man. I mean, we could go on.
Yeah,
and on.
Yeah, for sure. How did skating take you to photography? Since we're, you know, the film photography podcast out here, we need.
I know, right? People are like, is this the slap message board?
No, no, I love it though, because we never get to talk about that stuff. We always rush into photography. I love hearing your background.
And we also talked to quite a few skate people who are parallel. So it's fascinating to me to like see the parallels between those two worlds. We've talked to
Jason Lee.
Yeah. Yeah, a bunch of people.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So I would say it this way, man. It's like, you know, it's all, first off, it's all about accessibility. Accessibility is everything. Yeah. Like, and so skateboarding made these other interests accessible for me. Not only made it accessible, but presented it to me in a way that I could see the qualities of it and get excited about it. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is being on the other, you know, if we're talking about photography, being on the other end of the camera, growing up with so many amazing skate photographers, and at a time where they were shooting film and they had their own dark rooms. And if they shot for the magazine, whether it's Thrasher, Transworld, the magazine had a dark room. And you had certain guys that would go in and not only shoot, but then go print their image and give it to the magazine, you know? And then the mags had their own printers that and everything. And so growing up at a time where I'm exposed to that process and going out with like a Tobin Yeelan or Gabe Mulford getting, when I say go out, we'd link up so that they could shoot a skate photo of me skating, right? And then the next time I see them handing me a print that they made in their dark room. You know what I mean? And so, or when they'd have like a art show or something, seeing these prints hanging up on the wall that they made. No different than vinyl growing up. You know, my dad was a sax player, you know. I say was because he passed away in 97, but he played sax and played in a jazz band. And so I grew up with a lot of music around me and his record collection. And so, you know, and again, in the 70s, listening to this stuff, I always say you can't be unaware of something. If you're aware of something, you can't be unaware of it. And I guess what I'm trying to say is my reference point musically with being aware of what vinyl sounds like, I can't be unaware of the inherent qualities of that needle on that vinyl, right? And I guess what I'm trying to say too is skateboarding, experiencing skateboarding or experiencing photography through skateboarding at a time when they're making prints and stuff, now I'm aware. I have an emotional connection to the inherent qualities of what I'm feeling from everything a part of this print, the emotional connection to the person on the photo, but then the way that it's expressed with the depth and the richness of the print, and then just having the utmost respect for the craftsmanship of it. Like, I was just as excited about these dudes doing it on their own than I was even the print itself. You know, it's like, man, you did this yourself, that DIY thing.
Dude, yes.
You know what I mean? So growing up with that, it gave me a desire, though it didn't happen until later, it was all that that informed the interest and the passion to eventually want to start shooting photos and making prints. I mean, there's a lot of things. Like, I got to a point, like in probably in 95 when I was on a big tour, we were out for like 2 months and there was a bunch of us. It was like a Firm Vans tour kind of thing. The skateboard team that Lance Mountain had formed called the Firm. And then Vans Shoes. And so we were on this long like US tour, almost 2 months. And like about a week in, I was just like, man, I'm blowing it. Like, I'm missing moments.
Oh, yeah.
Like, this is a special time. Mm-hmm. And the photographer on the trip, my friend Joe Brooke, who was working for Slap Magazine at the time. Now he works for Thrasher Magazine. I was telling Joe, I was like, man, I want to get a camera. And he's like, Ray, we're going to be in New York in about 4 days. I'll take you to a camera store called B&H and I'll tell you the camera to get. And then sure enough, we got to New York. Right when we got there, we go to B&H and then we go to the counter. And then Joe proceeds to ask for a Yashica T4 and paid probably $80-something.
That's what I was going to ask you that. I wanted to know what you paid for it back then.
Yeah.
T4 is one of my favorite cameras, so yeah, I was dying to hear that story.
Yeah, it's rad. And so, yeah. And the thing about the T4, what they were all hyped about, because all of the skate photographers grabbed one. And I remember thinking it was kind of odd. I was like, why are you guys all excited about this one point and shoot camera? And they were just like, it's got Carl Zeiss optics. and I was like, okay.
You know?
Yeah, I was like, all right. And so that T4 that I got on that trip, you know, that was the start. That was the equivalent of me kind of seeing my buddy Danny's skateboard and being like, I want one of those. I want to do that. That T4 was kind of, that was kind of the window into the desire to want to shoot photos and make prints. But it wasn't for years later till I got to the point of like getting a manual camera and then that being really tied to a desire to want to make, get in the darkroom and learn how to print.
Man,
like it was interesting because that was the main pull, was like, I want to learn how to make prints that I can get excited about. And it's almost like the print, wanting to do the print was first.
Yeah.
You know, but it's all wrapped up in there. But that didn't happen. That didn't happen until, I don't know, what was that? Like 2008, maybe?
Wow.
Where I finally was like, because I noticed this about myself. I see it even now where I'll look at things and be like, man, one day I want to like learn that, try that. And my wife had this Pentax K1000 that she had from like just gotten in college or something. And it's funny because it would be on our mantle, and that K1000, it represented the craft, because I knew as much as I dug the T4 and shot with it religiously, if you will, forever, I knew that I wasn't doing what those guys were doing.
Yeah.
And I started to see how, man, there were certain things that I wished I saw when I shot it, but when I got it back, it was a whole nother story. And so I knew that there was a sense of like, I'm cheating. Or there was a sense of like, you know what, this thing's making the decisions for me. Mm-hmm. And so that Pentax K1000, it represented the craft to me. It represented what my friends knew that I was like, man, one day I want to learn. But I would look at that Pentax K1000. I would look on it on and off for like a good 5 years saying that to myself. But then what happens is then it just starts to get to a point where it's just like, okay, it's got to happen now, because it just kind of starts to nag and eat at me, and the desire gets stronger to be like, okay. And so when it was getting really, when I got back from a trip, I was riding for a clothing company out of Sweden called WeSC, and it was a skate camp that they were doing, and I had a digital point and shoot, and I remember just being so bummed about just the images and missing the latency that digital camera had, and I missed the moment. And I remember getting home from that trip and just being like, looking at the images and being frustrated, then looking over at the Pentax K1000 and being like, okay, I want to figure it's this time. Out.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing I didn't have the answer for was that I wanted to print. I knew I wanted to shoot black and white, and I wanted to get in the darkroom and make darkroom prints. And so I didn't know. The only people I knew that had a darkroom that could possibly teach me were my friends Ed and Deanna Templeton. But I knew that, like, man, they're so busy, they're not going to be able to hold my hand through learning how to print. And so it wasn't until I was skating, you know, I was living, you know, was married, and living in Long Beach and skating Cherry, which is the local park here in Long Beach, where it's not a skate park, but the city lets us put, you know, it's like a Love Park when Love Park was allowing people to skate kind of thing, right? And so I was just talking with some skaters and talking about photography and me saying like, yeah, I want to learn how to print. And they're like, oh, we print over at the Long Beach Community College. And we took one course for the beginning black and white. And from there, we just have access to the lab and we just go there using the lab now. And then I was like, okay, there we go. And so, yeah. And so then I got online, signed up, but the semester wasn't for like another, it was still in the middle of the semester. So I couldn't hop into the next semester. So it was like, okay, cool. I saw the finish line. I saw where, like, okay, I can get into print. So then it was like, I remember going to my wife and being like, okay, so how do you use this thing? And it was funny because she was like, well, my teacher said, you put this knob here, and you put this knob here, and you turn this knob to get the needle to line up. And basically it was just the, you know, aperture priority kind of setting, you know? And then I remember going out with that and just, I knew I could shoot color and get an idea of what I'm doing because I can go get that process at Costco or whatever. Yeah, yeah. And so I did that until we got into until the semester started, and then that's when the fun began.
Yeah.
I mean, shooting was fun, but it is that Ansel Adams thing of just you're seeing the print with what you're shooting, you know.
Yeah.
And so anyways, yeah, that's how a lot of that began. But again, I credit it from the community that I'm so grateful to have been a part of to this day that functions, has so much talent and ability, and being exposed to that, inspired by that, and the resource of being taught in that also, you know, having friends that, because I respect their abilities, trusting their input on what I'm trying to do.
It's amazing how giving the community is. And I mean, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing right now if it wouldn't have been for friends that were looking out for me when I had questions. And
yeah,
you know, all the way back to even like skateboarding and stuff, just how like intertwined these arts are, you know. Like, I always looked at skating as an art. I've always looked at, you know, music as an art and its self-expression. The same with photography. I always wanted to be a painter, but I couldn't paint. So photography was
there too.
Photography was like the next best thing to get my like emotive process out. Like, how can I manipulate the scene to get, but.
Yeah. You know, for me, I always admire painting, but I think for me, what I'm realizing is that my heroes, their approach to photography came more from painters than other photographers. Kind of like, you know, a lot of my heroes, musically, jazz players like Wes Montgomery, he came more from piano, dude. The guy's like wanting to inspired and approaching it from a piano place and applying that to, you know, when I say a piano place, a piano player's approach to the harmony and voicings of chords. And he drew from that to apply that to the guitar. And so I think for me, that's where my emotional connection is to painting, or desire nowadays to want to paint, because it's through painting that all of my favorite photographers, I feel, have drawn inspiration from or apply what they're trying to do close to, more to that than this photography-based kind of thing. You know, it just reminds me of the jazz guys. Drawing from other instruments for their phrasing. Like, when I say jazz guys, jazz guitarists.
Yeah.
They drew from horn phrasing or drew from a piano player's voicings for chords and things like that. It's interesting seeing. I love how other things can inform other things.
For sure. Yeah.
You know.
I saw this this video of you, Ray, in the dark room, and it got me excited because I like remember that experience, but I haven't really been in it like that in a very long time. There's the video where you guys were doing liquid emulsion on a skateboard.
Oh, dude, love that video.
Oh,
so much.
Yeah.
It's funny. Yeah. I like when I first started photography before I went to school for it, I wanted to do like liquid emulsion on a drum head for.
Yeah. Oh, rad.
The guy that I was dating at the time, and I never got to use it. I think I was like intimidated by like not getting it to work. But when I saw that video of the skateboard, I was like, it works. It works. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, I want to try that so bad.
That was a fun experiment. That was my buddy, Brian Gaberman. Man, what a beautiful eye. Just you talk about craftsman, like just a master printer. And Brian's out in Sebastopol, California. And him and his family have a farm out there. And so one of the sheds, it's a dark room.
Yeah.
And so, we were able to.
I know.
Yeah, right. And so, that was a process because you're basically, right, what a liquid emulsion does is it turns any surface into photographic paper, if you will, right? And so what was really hard for us was to figure out how to manage contrast. Because you can't use filters, it's not a multi-layered. It's like a fixed grade, if you will, like before they started doing multi-grade papers, right? And so a fixed grade, it's, you know, stuck to one grade. So you're getting one contrast, right? And so what was really tough was to try to get a decent contrast out of, and we learned that the density of the blacks has to do with the density of the emulsion. So, and we learned that brushing was too inconsistent. And that's how we found out when we brush it, there'd be a little more emulsion in certain places and those ones would be darker. And so what we figured out is we had to pour it and then kind of tilt it and let it spread out. And it stayed a little more consistent in its thickness. But there were like little things we had to do where you make the developer a little, you know, that trick of the developer is hotter than temperature, then it'll start to punch it a little quick, you know, can punch it quicker than, you know. And so there was a lot of hurdles, but it was really cool at the end to finally kind of see it come together.
Did you only do it on one board? Like, did you try and
do? No, we did probably 10 total, but the keepers were like 6 maybe.
Wow.
Yeah.
But the goal was to take it to my friend Sean Cliver, who drew my first graphic on Palo Peralta, the ragdoll, and have him draw a ragdoll on it. It was a panoramic shot where I left room for him to paint the ragdoll.
Yeah, it came out so cool.
Yeah, it was a heavy one it was a tough one, I should say, for Sean because it's tough to paint on that emotion.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine.
I love that. He was just like, I was just so worried I was going to screw it up.
Yeah, but he did great. And it's a special one. And I'm grateful to have it. But he snuck it to me.
Oh, you got it. Oh, cool. I'm so glad.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have it. Yeah, I have it. Yeah.
So are you still, I mean, I know times are crazy now, obviously, with COVID and everything, but do you spend time in a dark room pretty frequently, normally?
I wish I had my own dark room. And so basically I print at the Irvine Fine Arts Community Center in the city of Irvine. So obviously with all this going on, that's been closed.
Yeah.
And it's crazy because if I had my own setup, man, I probably have a show ready to hang right now.
Really?
Yeah. But so yeah, I really miss it. And I'm not sure what that's going to look like with that opening up.
I know everybody who's got a dark room at home right now must be in heaven.
They're so high.
Just having the time right now. Jeez.
Right, I know.
Yeah. Man. Yeah.
So has the virus stuff affected you at all with like skating or shooting or, you know, I'm sure, I know music isn't touring and stuff right now too.
Yeah. Well, on the music and playing, recording more and doing things. Cool. And so, being busy on that end of things. Shooting, yeah, not so much. I mean, I have a project that I want to start working on, and that's pushing towards more landscapey kind of thing.
Cool.
with a X-Pan and a 30 millimeter mm-hmm. lens for that X-Pan. And so I want to start working on that. But typically how I shoot, it's just documenting your life,
right.
you know? And so, you know, and a lot of that is what I'm so thankful to have the opportunity to do, which is travel and be a part of this community and doing things. So, you know, my family's at the point where they're just so over the camera, and my boys are at an age where I want to respect that, you know? So it's not too much shooting in quarantine.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I miss it. And, but there's projects and things. So I'm working on a project right now with Vans and Leica. Actually, they're doing a shoot together and I'm a part of that.
Oh, no kidding.
And so
that's awesome.
I'm putting images together for that and stuff. So there's like editing and some processing kind of thing, but skating, yeah, I'd go out by myself, but really try to adhere to just trying to be safe, you know? I don't want to bring anything back for my family, you know, and to have to deal with virus-wise. And so just now, yeah, trying to get out a little more. But like most people, just dealing with gaining a lot of weight.
Yeah, yeah. Amen.
Quarantine 15.
Yeah.
Quarantine 15, yeah. Except mine might be more than 15, maybe, but... But yeah, so yeah, kind of working on a music project right now. And so,
man, I'm stoked on that. You've been a part of I do a daily walk. I was recently sick found out I was diabetic and all this stuff right before the whole quarantine happened. And I, you know, my doctor's like, you need to get exercise. You need to get out and do stuff. And, you know, I used to skate every day. I'm definitely like almost 40. I'll be 40 at the end of this year. And it scares me to get on a skateboard now a little bit, you know, because I'm just not, I don't have the legs for it anymore. But just going for walks and stuff, I've really been jamming out to your older catalog of tunes, just stuff that I missed out in the past that I just didn't listen to, you know. And man, just like you have the perfect tunes for cruising out and like taking photos and just being like upbeat and like cruising. I'm just really enjoying
man.
The music these days.
Right on, man.
So Ray, do you still have the T4?
Yes, I do. But it's not the same one. Yeah,
they tend to wear out.
Yeah, I just had a bunch over the years, but I do have one right now that I need to get back from my buddy.
I always wondered what they were at, like how much they cost at retail. It's crazy to think that you like went into a B&H and like bought one.
Yeah, it was under 100 for sure.
That's wild.
I remember that. Yeah. And what are they going for now? I don't even know. It's crazy.
Four or five.
Definitely four.
Yeah.
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 Or $4, depending.
Yeah.
You find
You're it. Right. Yeah. No, I've got that friend, man. I've got that friend where he's like, I found this for $10.
Yeah. That's you know? My dream. It's never happened to me. Not yet. Someday, hopefully.
I've had it happen with the, why am I going to space the name? Olympus Stylus.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
With the 2.8. Mm-hmm. And it's the little soap bar guy mm-hmm. that you can open it yep. up from. I found that for $10 at a
Dude,
Goodwill.
Score.
And but you know what? As cool as that camera is, I struggled with its lack of being able to focus on what I was trying to focus it on. It'd always be like the ear was in focus and the face was soft or something. Like I don't know if it was just that one in particular, but I remember that was the bummer part about it. It would miss focus, that autofocus thing.
Yeah. I was just talking to Chris before we hopped on here. I've been shooting one of those again, the Epic, and I was taking some kind of long-distance landscapey shots with...
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And I've noticed that you know how when...
The vignette?
Yeah, or like the aberration too, like when the stuff starts to kind of like turn in on itself on the corners of the... And I mean, I know you can fix that in Lightroom or whatever, but you don't want to be doing that with your film photos.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what's funny? There was a moment, it's kind of one of those kind of revelation kind of moments where, because I eventually, early on with the Pentax K1000, I was just like, man, the moments that I want to capture, this mirror slap is just way too loud, right? And then I remember talking with one of my favorite photographers, John Humphreys, and I remember just kind of whining to John about, like, man, this thing's so loud. And he's like, you need to get a rangefinder. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what's a rangefinder? And then when I go do research and find out and then realize, like, you know what? That's what I need, a rangefinder. And then end up with a very fortunate to have my friend Robbie Jeffers. He saw me with a camera that I got from another friend. Because one of the things that was really cool about getting into photography and, you know, film at that and printing is all of my friends that are photographers that shoot for a living, they had to move on to digital.
Yeah.
But they still had this emotional connection to their film gear. Mm-hmm. And because that stuff depreciated so much, they weren't just going to sell it for nothing. So they kept it. And then here I come along being all super excited about printing and shooting film. And so they're just like handing me cameras and lenses to try out because they're excited about that stuff being used, not just sitting around, right. You know? And so I had a friend, my friend Ray Zimmerman, who's another great eye, really good photographer, skate photographer. I mean, he shoots everything, but most people would know him as MRZ and shooting a lot of skateboarding, a lot of transition. And anyways, Ray was like, I was telling him about like wanting a rangefinder, and he was like, well, I found this Minolta CLE in Texas one year on a job, and I didn't know if it worked, but I knew the lens was good because the Minolta CLE was an offshoot of the Leica CL. Like Leica and Minolta were in cahoots with each other for this like kind of, I don't want to say entry level rangefinder, but it was definitely an Econo version.
Yeah,
of the rangefinder.
It's a unique little thing.
And it's a 40 millimeter lens, but it was known that the M. Roker 40 and then the 40 Summicron were the same lens. And so anyways, Ray picked that camera up, gave it, the camera that he picked up that he was telling me about that he got in Texas, he was like, you know, you can have it. I don't know if it works. And sure enough, it didn't work. But my man Steve at Steve's Camera here in Culver City, I'm so thankful for him because he does such a great job servicing my cameras and anybody who has Leica or Hasselblad and mostly film cameras. And he got it up and going. Yeah. And so I had the CLE cruising around. And then I ran into my buddy Robbie Jeffers, who saw me with the CLE, and he's like, Ray, I've got an M6 that I don't use. Why don't you take that thing? Yeah. He was like, why don't you take that thing? And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, man, I don't use it. You were shooting digital, you know? And so I was getting ready to go with my friends. I was playing with my buddies, Jonathan and Jared. They have a band called The Matson 2. We did an album together, and it's titled Ray Barbie Meets The Matson 2. And so that album had just come out, and we were touring in Japan. And it was a pretty big tour. And so he gave me that M6 with two lenses. Ugh. And so there was a 35 lens and a 50.
Oh, perfect.
And
that's perfect.
Yeah.
And
the
so,
setup right there.
Yeah, I'm going out there with those two lenses. And it was funny because, I don't do good with options. And so every morning in the hotel room, I'm like, what lens am I going to take out right now?
The battle.
And so I started with the 50. And then when I put the 35 on, spent a day with the 35. Then the next day when I was looking at the two lenses, I was like, nah, I like the 35. And so I guess what I'm trying to get to is that then, you know, I get back from the tour. I was on assignment because my buddy Martin was working for this magazine called Giant Robot. It was an Asian culture magazine. And he was like, Ray, you know, you're excited about photography. Like, you're telling me that you're going to shoot this tour. Like, shoot an article for the mag.
That's so,
you know?
Awesome.
So I'm going out there being like, okay.
Wow.
Like, you know? And so I get back and I've got all of these like crazy various film stocks because, again, just like with the cameras, people were like giving me old film and just like, here, Ray, I got all this Tri-X or tape. I was all over the place. So when I'm at school processing this stuff, I'm like asking them at the school, like, what developer do I use for this? And I was so all over the place, and I was expressing that to Ray, my buddy Ray, that I'd mentioned. And I was like, man, like, this is frustrating. He's like, man, you need to stick with one camera, one lens, one film stock, and one paper, and one developer, and just learn it. And it's funny because it's been X amount of years of that. I've never changed from that. But the lens that I committed to was the 35. And it's funny because years later, I'm like, wow, this makes sense, because basically what I have is a glorified version of a T4. I was like, that T4 has trained me to see in a 35 perspective.
Man.
You know? And I was just like, oh, like making that connection was really interesting, because it was like, and you know what's so amazing to me about the 35, at least, I always say like my M6 is a fixed lens camera. What's interesting about the 35, I think what I realized is that I was excited about the school of you don't crop in the enlarger. You know what I mean? You run your full borders. What you placed is what you saw at the moment. You know what I mean? And so a 28 would give me too much to manage. I couldn't get things. I couldn't exclude things in my frame. And then a 50 was just too tight. I always wanted a little more to work with and to play with, you know. So the 35 always sat really nice. But what trips me out, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at, is that I had an opportunity to hang photos and perform at Leica's headquarters in Wetzlar, Germany.
Wow. Oh, wow.
They built a hotel and a museum and a building for their cinema lenses there at the headquarters. And so for the grand opening festival celebration, they asked if I'd come out and be a part of it and perform 2 days. But they were like, Ray, we'd like for you to hang your photos also. And so when I thought about, like, man, what am I gonna hang there? And like, for me, Leica, all of my heroes come from that brand, you know, the legacy of that brand, and my heroes from it's like Fender to Hendrix and Clapton's and whoever's, you know what I mean? And so I knew it was going to be modern, because they said, we want you to be a part of this exhibition where the musicians are photographers. And so I knew like some of the other photographers were going to be hanging inkjets, you know? But the part of Leica that I have an emotional connection to is those guys that function through printing themselves, so, you know, or the master printers over at Magnum doing their work or things like that, you know? And so I'm very grateful that they allowed me to print my own work.
Man, that's so
but
cool.
It's funny because I was trying to figure out what the theme would be, and I called it 10 years with one camera and one lens. And basically it was me trying to say, like, I know I'm a newbie in all of this, but I have put in a little bit of work, just a little bit, but it was really important for me to try to represent that culture of the photographers that inspired me with Leica, you know? And then I was like, I want to represent skateboarders, because skateboarders aren't afraid to dig in and do the hard work.
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
People would think that the craft of processing your own film and getting in the dark room and printing your own work, like, skateboarders excited about that challenge and doing that.
I love that.
And so what I realized after looking over years of negs and everything, editing, it made me realize, like, I think I'm just scratching the surface of this 35. Like, for there still to be this, like, wow, there's still so much that can be done with this. It was surprising, because I thought, like, man, maybe it'd be time to move on. You burn out on a focal length. But but it's got more to do with this than the focal length. And you got your feet. So your feet will...
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like that's so important, though. I feel like we've stressed that a couple times on the show. Like, one camera, one lens, one film stock. Just like... making it, you know, and it is fun to kind of play around with new stuff, but I always have, like, now that I have a Leica, finally, thank you, Thank you, Lord.
Yeah, yeah. That, so jealous. So that, unfair.
That it, you know, it's always loaded with the Tri-X pushed to 1600, you know, 35 millimeter like you. And you know, I throw a little point and shoot in my bag with some color film in it, because there's always that time when you're out and you're like, oh, man, if I had color film right now. But mm-hmm. I just think to learn like your style and even being like honed in on the craft, I wouldn't even need the light meter on my camera, because I'm just so used to knowing and judging. And there's so much latitude in film, too. Like, even if you are a little off, like it. It's still, you know, mm-hmm. it's just, yeah. I think that's so important. And I'm stoked that you took 10 years to.
I mean, and it's a personality thing. Like, cause my buddy Robbie, he gets excited about so much. He's got so many different cameras, so many different lenses, and he does and it doesn't hinder him. It inspires him. And so it's a personality thing too. One thing that I see as a result of sticking with one thing for some time is when you're able to be familiar with something, then that gets out of the way when you're trying to get ideas out.
Right.
You've taken one less equation. That's what I'm trying to get to, is when you're sticking with one lens, one camera, one developer, one film stock, then you can be familiar and now you know what to anticipate. And the cool thing about sticking with one focal length for so long, that even happens in your vision. Like, I know what's in my frame before I even put the camera to my eye.
100%.
So it's all about familiarity. It's all about having, you hear people saying how they want it. You know, they would say that about Jimi Hendrix. Like, that was an appendage for him. He was one with his guitar.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's that idea of getting that much closer to you. And so that familiarity, that's kind of what the desire is when you're trying to stick with one thing, because what you're trying to do is become so accustomed to it that it gets out of the way and it becomes more closer to you, and you just function without having to, you know, think about it, and you can just keep concentrating on the idea or what you're excited about, and then the rest is just like, it'd be a bummer if we were like, we're hungry and we're trying to eat, and we're sitting here still trying to figure out how to hold the spoon.
Yeah. So true.
Perfect metaphor.
We don't think about it. We just grab that spoon. Right. We know the posture we need to sit. It needs to sit in and scooping up. And it's getting that to that place with your equipment. You know, like if what you're excited about is the meal, if you will, then you just want to be like, okay, let's get it.
Yeah.
Not like, dang, what am I, how do I hold? Which finger, what's the configuration on holding it, you know?
And it's nothing worse than getting like a new setup and being like so unfamiliar with it. Like, it's a good feeling when you're just like, this is my, you know, like appendage, like you said, like, I'm just gonna, it's an extension of me and I know where I'm going with it and stuff like that.
But it takes time for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
And then that time takes longer when you're trying to do that between multiple things.
Right.
At the same time, trying to learn guitar, drums, and bass at the same time. You know what I mean? But people can do it.
Yeah.
That's why it's like, I'm just saying me, personality thing, or just things that I've kind of, the hard way, in a frustrating way, have come to, you know.
Man, I think you need things to balance that out, though. Because, I mean, I did the musician thing for years, too. And anytime I would take time away from my drum set, if the band I was playing with, we took a break for a while, and then, you know, say a year later, let's get the band back together. Dude, my hunger for drumming and playing is so much more. Burnout is such a real thing, you know. If you just, like, put all your pennies in one, you know, one basket, that's a horrible way to say that. I don't think that's a phrase, but if you know what I mean, you go for it all on one thing, you can really wear yourself out. So I think it's important to have music and skateboarding or gardening and, you know, whatever it is that kind of keeps you going.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm more speaking towards people who are frustrated with their progress or lack thereof.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's more of what I mean. It's like, because people can get discouraged and not really know why, but a lot of it can kind of, you can kind of see that, well, maybe you need to trim it down and just, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
And you know how it is too, like what they call gearheads or gear acquisition-itis or whatever. You know, it's like sometimes people are just so caught up on the next thing that's that saying it's going to help you do this thing. You never get to this thing that you're saying that you want that to do.
Right.
You're just caught up. You're caught up in, you know, getting, it becomes a loop.
It does.
Right.
That you don't realize, or you apply the progression to the wrong thing. The progression's not what the marketing is telling you it is. The progression's in the work ethic and you getting in there and doing it. But there is this idea that this piece of gear is going to get me over this hump or get me there.
Yep.
And it very rarely does that. I mean, for people that have vision and they can really identify how this thing will help and how that's missing in what they already have. But the thing is a lot of times it's not missing in what people already have. It's just the Minutemen, one of my favorite bands. They always had this, they have this song where there's a lyric like, let the product sell themselves.
Yes.
and it's kind of this thing of like, you can get so caught up in the marketing of something. It can make you think that you need that when you kind of already have it in a lot of ways.
Wow. Yeah.
With what you already have, you know what I mean?
Is there any plans to put like a book together or?
Yeah. I mean, there's the grand idea of, yeah, doing a book. A couple, there's one that I'm working on where I want to use a panoramic camera.
Yeah.
And I'd imagine that one would happen before kind of the bigger idea of the 10 years with one camera, one lens. Like, I encourage everybody who shoots a lot or who's really trying to, I guess, grow in their craft of shooting is like, it was huge for me to look at, you know, I looked over 300 rolls of film for the last 10 years to try to pick out, like I said, that I needed at least 15. And so to whittle all that down, to try to figure out like, what is this?
Wow.
What is the narrative? What is the theme of all this stuff? And I'm shooting anything and everything. But it was through that process of making proof sheets, going through it. My friend Thomas Campbell gave me the best advice, which was huge for me because he helped me edit. He was like, look, I don't want to see all this proof sheet. He was like, here's what you do. You just go through them, and things that catch your interest, just mark them, start whittling it down and see what it wants to be, you know?
Wow, that is.
And through that process, it was really cool. It became a mirror into my practice, into what I'm trying to get at. You see what you're up to, basically. And in doing that, it was really enlightening. I was like, wow. I've tried to shoot this a lot of times and it's never worked. I should give up on that idea, you know? And so I encourage people to look at their work, look at all of it and kind of have it show you what gives you a good insight of what you're up to, you know, and you can kind of from there start to you can assess from there how you want to move forward. You know, and if there's certain things like that I saw where I'm like, okay, I'll give that up and start like, man, okay, this is what this wants to be. Let me hone in on this and try to develop this more, you know, and I found a lot of themes.
Yeah.
I've got folders of just themes, stuff that I just always gravitate and shoot subconsciously, not even knowing it.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, wow, like always shooting. I love seeing people reading the print, you know, like a book, not the phone, you know, and when I see that, I would shoot, not even think I'm working on anything. But now that I see it, I'm like, I'm going to keep with that. So you get themes that become kind of parts of your, if you shoot the way that, like that I shoot, where you're just kind of, I don't even know what it is. You're just shooting. I mean, you're shooting your life. And so it's fun to have those little things too, where you're like, oh, I can add on to this. Here's another one. Becomes almost like a scavenger hunt. Because for me, what I love about photography and how it works and fits in perfectly with me playing music and skating is all traveling and stuff, you always have downtime.
Yeah.
And there's very, you know, such a fun way to take in a new city or country or anything through the lens. Just walking around, just seeing, especially when we're touring and, you know, playing music and you've got sound check at 2 o'clock and then doors don't open till 10.
Yeah,
you don't go on until 11:30 or whatever. And you're hanging with everybody. and you might be the only skater, then it's like fun to be shooting, you know what I mean? And so in editing, depending on how you shoot, you see little things like that, like, oh, I'm going to keep with this idea and I'm going to keep with this. But I would love to do a book where it's just kind of your, kind of like the 10 years with one camera, one lens, and the themes of that, do a whole book with that.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea.
But that's a lot, you know, you got to shoot a lot to get a little.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, that's the crazy part. Yeah.
So we'll stay tuned.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Don't give up. Yeah. You might want to give up. Another 10 years and the team still hasn't done this.
20 years with one camera.
Yeah.
One.
We'll be right back with a listener question for Ray right after this message from our sponsor.
Support for Analog Talk comes from Polaroid. Use the promo code ANALOGTALK10 on your first purchase on film at Polaroid.com.
All right, guys, this is the part of the show where we take a question from one of our listeners. And this week's question comes from Jake Aaron Photography. And he asks, who was / is your favorite skate photographer to work with?
Oh, to work with?
Yeah. Well, I missed that last part.
Dude, my man, Anthony Acosta, we did a interview for the Skateboard Mag. They're no longer around, but forget how many years ago. And that was one of the funnest interviews to work on because, you know, I've been friends with Anthony before doing that, but just when you're working on a project together and you get a chance to hang out so much. And what was really fun about that too is that Anthony's a ripper, man. So a lot of times we'd get to a spot and he'd get it cooking. He'd already be ripping. And then so that would motivate me, you know, which is pretty rare rare experience with the, and it's not that other photographers don't skate, but you know, Anthony used to be sponsored.
Yeah. Mm.
Anthony was a sponsored skateboarder that kind of concentrated a little more concentrated a little more with shooting photos, but never gave up skating. So he's still skating at a high level. And so that was a really fun experience because that was the first time where like I'm skating and being pushed by the photographer.
That's so awesome.
He's not letting you fake it.
I'm more saying that was a fun experience. That question reminded me of the uniqueness of that experience.
Yeah.
You know?
It's great.
Man, I also love your story of working with Spike when you realized that like coming to a spot at a certain time is like a thing, you know, lighting and all that stuff. I love those moments when things click. Like it's like one of my favorite things.
Yeah. And Spike shot my first Trans World interview. I think my first interview that I had gotten as a pro, Spike shot it.
Wow.
And yeah. And it was a lot of like, all right, Ray, let's go to the spot. Let's go check it out. And it'd be like noon or something. And I'd be like ready to get the trick. And he's like, okay, cool. Let's want to go eat or something. Yeah. Like, we'll come back. We'll come back at around 5 or something. Yeah. I was like, wait.
It's that golden hour.
Yeah, he knew. A lot of guys would just go raw and just be like, let's get it.
Yeah, you know? That's fun.
That's awesome. So. Okay, so we got two more questions for you, Ray.
All right.
If you could only have one camera, like your desert island camera the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
Yeah, so it'd be my trusty M6, like a M6.
Nice.
Because it's funny because that's how I function now. I just shoot with that thing and yeah, with the trusty 35 Summicron.
Beautiful.
It's a 80s version. Oh no, I'm sorry. Well, it's 80s, but it's Canadian.
Oh, the Canadian one. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's the Canadian 35. I love that thing. Nice and small.
You have the black one, right?
Yeah. But you know what's interesting? You know, what I feel about rangefinders is that the magnification determines what lens functions the best on that body.
Yeah.
And so I feel like there's only one focal length that functions the best for each magnification. And so, I think a big part of the 35 being the lens that I ended up just keeping on my camera on the M6 when I had the 50 and the 35 was that with the 0.72, it just was comfortable where the frame lines landed. I could see everything, all the corners, but I could see past them too, because that's the beauty of a rangefinder's you can get an idea of what's getting ready to come in the frame or whatever, or what you want to include, you know. But if I had a 0.85, which I did for a little bit, I didn't like the 35 on a 0.85. That magnification pushed the frame lines out of my view.
Oh, okay.
I couldn't see the corner. Yeah. And it had a different feel. The 50 sat a little bigger with the 0.85, and I felt like the 50 was the sweet spot, you know. A 0.58, because I have a buddy that has a 0.58, and that makes his 35 look like a 50 on a 0.72. I'm sorry, 6.8, I think. One of those. There's like a 6.8 or 5. I think it's 5.8, actually.
Yeah, I think it's 5.
But that makes the 28 fit closer to a 35 on a 0.72. So anyways, like, so going back to the desert island camera and everything, it's like, that is why I love that setup. It's a 0.72 with the 35 that just sits. It functions the best on that. But that's just how I see. That's how I see the world too, though. I just see it in a 35. Mm-hmm. So I'd have no problem with that camera, because that's how I'm functioning to this day. That is the only thing I'm using.
Perfect.
Good answer.
The second part of the question is, any white whale cameras, anything you're dying to try, you haven't got to shoot yet? Maybe some large, medium, large format?
I'm not going to lie, it would be super fun to shoot 8x10.
Yeah.
But 8x10 color.
Yeah.
That would be so fun. I'm not a color guy, but I would love to see color in like a
huge,
large format that.
That's good. That's a great answer. Yep. Love that. Ray, this has been amazing. Thank you for taking the time to chat with us. We really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on. This is super cool. I'm excited to check out. I'm just getting hip to you guys, so I'm excited to check out the past podcast.
There's some good ones out there, man.
Yeah.
Well, super honored. Thanks, you guys.
Yeah. Where can everybody check you out? Do you have a website? I know Instagram, obviously, but...
Yeah, I'm just Instagram, cool. And I'm pretty bad at it, but... that's pretty much it. And excited about doing some scanning and putting up more photos.
Yes, please.
So...
And that book.
Totally. Well, right on, you guys.
Thanks, Ray. We'll see you in the next one. Bye.
All right, first off, Chris and I would like to thank Ray for coming on the show. What an absolute honor. Like, I've been following your career, Ray, for as long as I can remember. Definitely a huge fan of your skating, of your music, of your photography. Like, I'm just so stoked that we got you on the show. I know Chris is as well, but this is a huge moment. Thanks, Ray. Really appreciate it. Guys, we forgot to drop our socials at the end of this episode like we normally do. I'm sure you know by now where we are. I'll leave those linked in the show notes, as they are all the time. Guys, that's going to take me to Patreon. Head over to patreon.com/analogtalk. We've got a bunch of stuff over there, some Patreon after shows, Patreon show exclusives, and then also, for just a buck, you can get the show 2 days early. So it comes out every Monday morning, and that's, you know, 2 days before Wednesday, when Wednesday's our normal drop day. So there's a bunch of stuff over there. Patreons who already help support the show, guys, thank you so much. Chris and I appreciate you, and, you know, you free up that little bit of extra time for us to make this all possible. All right, guys, so until next week, we'll see you soon. Later.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.